Thank you so much. And I understand that this is a 1 hour slot.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, just to be mindful of everyone's time. Yeah, in back in 2019 when I was here and I spent the fall semester at PI, it was a lot of fun. And I presented a colloquium where I talked about this, actually the paper that came before this one, when we were saying, well, you know what, maybe we can see it. So then we set out to try to find it, and to everyone's surprise, including ours, we did. So let me tell you a little bit more about what this is, because this work tried to put a lot of stuff together, and I'm very interested in hearing the questions that you may have and possible interpretations, and please interrupt me at any time. Okay, so this you have seen before, the simulation, but this is actually the sound test for the more interesting visualization that I'm going to have later. So when we are talking about binary neutron star mergers, we're going to have a gravitational wave signal, and we are going to also emit a gamma ray burst. So let's see if the sound works. There you go, wait for it. Okay, so we are mostly going to be concerned with what happens between the whoop and the ding that I just showed to you. And the sad thing is that what happens then is going to be the whoop gives you an increasing frequency, that's the chirp of the gravitational wave signal. And you can see that the frequency is increasing there in gravitational waves. And that frequency scale there going to 300 hertz, that's way before when the two neutron stars merge, because the two neutron stars, oh yeah, I remember that. guess I'm going to have to hold it all the time. Okay, that might be the first time I ever touched a hockey stick. So the two neutron stars merge with frequencies much higher than this. But if we look at the noise curves of the LIGO detectors, we can see that the noise increases a lot for higher frequencies. So the sweet spot for LIGO is about from 50 to 500 hertz. Neutron stars are going to merge at over 1,000 hertz. And what's going to happen with the gravitational wave signal after they merge is going to be definitely in the kilohertz range. So over here, where we really don't expect to see much with LIGO, we have different proposals of detectors that could do better in the higher frequencies, and that would be especially important for neutron star physics. Now, there's also a question of when the gamma ray burst is emitted. Is it emitted? Does it have to wait for a black hole to be formed after two neutron stars merge or not? And that's going to be important later on. After the two neutron stars merge, it is possible that a hypermassive neutron star is formed. And a hypermassive neutron star is going to collapse to form a black hole. There is no way around it. It cannot stay, it cannot live, it cannot be a stable neutron star, but it's going to live for about hundreds of milliseconds according to simulations. It's going to be spinning very fast and differentially. It's going to be oscillating and emitting those kilohertz gravitational waves, which are going to be the signature of this type of object. And as I mentioned to you before, that frequency is too high for the current detectors. Now, why hypermassive? We have information from simulations, and I'm a little bit weary of putting too much weight on what comes out of numerical relativity simulations. Some of my best friends do numerical relativity simulations. And and I did my postdoc in a numerical relativity group. I never did numerical relativity myself, but I know there are limitations on what can be done and what we can trust and what we cannot trust. But apparently, one of the things that we can trust and that lots of different groups agree on is the frequency of those gravitational waves, those kilohertz gravitational waves. People do agree on that. How long the hypermassive neutron star lives, that's something not everyone agrees on. But fortunately, I don't need to worry about that. But it could be, say, something that is approaching 2.5 solar masses. It's hard to define the radius for it. But more or less, maybe I can think of a radius of 20 kilometers for this object. And the differential rotation is crucial. It's called hypermassive neutron star because it is supported against gravitational collapse due to its fast and strongly differential rotation. Okay, so a word about the differential rotation here. It's we know that the sun rotates differentially. That has been studied. The best plot that I have seen of the differential rotation of the sun comes from Wikipedia, and I think it is very informative because we have this radial profile of the rotation changing with the latitude in the sun. And if we look at that, well, that's not all that unlike if, say, let's take this curve here. That's not too unlike what we see in simulations for hypermassive neutron stars. Now, this dashed curve up here, that's just showing you what the Keplerian angular velocity, the orbital angular velocity would be around the hypermassive neutron star. And here, this is a density profile of the star, where you see that this is far from being a spherically symmetric object, but if I get very close to its core, it's a little bit spherically symmetric. It's approaching a spherically symmetric configuration, but with lots of ejecta and these lobes here, material that is being shed away by the star on its way to its inevitable collapse to form a black hole. Okay. So here I need to make a description of the type of signal that we're going to be looking for. I can well define periodic signals, single frequency, constant. Are there any astrophysicists in the room? Raise your hand if you're here. Okay, so those two people in the back who claim to be astrophysicists, they might tell me, well, pulsars spin down. They don't have a single frequency that lives forever. For all intents and purposes, here they do. Okay, so what I'm going to need is not a periodic signal. It's a quasi-periodic signal. Now, I'm sure that pretty much everyone here has either been on the side of the stage or on the side of the audience when children are playing music. And you will agree with me that we have something very different from a single frequency that everyone is playing together. We have anything but that. So this not periodic signal, I'll call it quasi-periodic, it does not have a single frequency, can have many closed frequencies, time variation, or dissipation. So these are all possible causes for quasi-periodicity. Now, for astrophysical examples, we have seen quasi-periodic oscillations, or QPOs, in black holes in X-ray binaries. So these QPOs here are understood to be caused by details of the accreting matter, the accretion disk around this black hole. In the X-ray tail of magnetar giant flares, we have seen quasi-periodic oscillations as well. So we can see here these broad spectral features in the Fourier spectrum, and these are quasi-periodic oscillations.
So defining quasi-periodic oscillations as a collection of frequencies that are nearby and not one that wanders up and down?
We could have both. When you're doing your Fourier analysis, you need to take an interval of time to do that. So either if you have multiple frequencies contributing or a wandering frequency in time, when you do your Fourier analysis, you're going to see a broad peak in the spectrum. So you don't know.
You're going to consider either option as well.
if all that you see is what's in the spectrum, you don't know which case you had. Yeah. So you could have either of those. And you could even have a single frequency that never changes, but if you have dissipation, your peak also broadens in the spectrum. Okay. So for the case of hypermassive neutron stars, it is definitely one of those cases where I'm going to be looking for quasi-periodic oscillations and not periodic oscillations. This thing is short-lived, it's time-evolving, it's dissipative, although let's remember that the numerical codes also have additional numerical dissipation. So we might need to worry about that later. And this is an example of the spectrum of the post-merger gravitational wave signal, and we have this complicated structure, several broad peaks in the spectrum. Depending on the simulation, depending on who you ask, they're going to say there are three peaks, there are two peaks, there are two peaks, and then a main peak. There is main peak and secondary peaks on each side. But everyone agrees more or less on what the main peak is doing if you have the same initial conditions for the simulation. Now, the question is, given that those frequencies there, see the scale in kilohertz, are too high for our current gravitational wave detectors, we can ask, could the gamma ray burst show these two POs? Okay. So I know this title has a lot of letters and no words, but you know what I mean here. Looking for the QPOs in the GRBs, the question is how and when, I mean what? Okay, so there are two different possibilities, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time in this because that's an open question for people doing the simulations and trying to come up with interpretations. But basically, I have two different possibilities for how what's happening in the star in the center and it's emitted in gravitational waves could be connected to the gamma rays that we are seeing. And we have one possibility where you say the star is emitting gravitational waves because it has a quadrupolar mode of oscillation, the fundamental mode of oscillation of the star. And that's what it's emitting gravitational waves. The star is shaking like that with this pattern and with this frequency. Magnetic field lines thread through the star and outwards from the star and carry this information. Basically, I shake the star here, I wiggle that magnetic field line going up, like if I have a garden hose with water and I'm shaking it here, the water is shaking over there, and this could transmit the information far out of the star where the jet is being launched and the gamma rays are being emitted. Details, magnetic fields, and it's complicated, and let's talk about the second possibility. So the second possibility is kind of like more of a mechanical model for this. I have the two neutron stars that came together, they merged. I'm going to have a frequency that's related to how this entire thing is rotating. I'm going to have additional frequencies as to how this thing is compressing, coming together and apart. I have combinations of these frequencies. People have suggested this kind of mechanical model for explaining the gravitational wave signal. Fair enough. But then what about the gamma rays? You can have a modulated emission of mass, ejection of mass from this object in the center with that very same frequency. And then if your jet has to punch through this modulated ejecta, you could have the modulation of the jet. Now, this is interesting because if we have a picture like this, this could happen even after the hypermassive neutron star has collapsed and formed a black hole. And for some people, that's very important because numerically, it's easier to form a jet on a merger simulation after the black hole has been created than before the black hole has been created. But that is a technical problem, because for getting the jet before black hole formation, you need to resolve magnetic fields at very different scales. And that's just very technically challenging. Still, nature might choose to do it that way.
Can I ask you a silly question? So you had all these peaks in frequency, they thought like 5-6 gigahertz, kind of what sets the maximum frequency at which these things can oscillate and you will be stuck? Will you have like a 20 gigahertz?
Right. There is one thing which is the maximum frequency that you could physically have, and the maximum frequency that you could observe that's related to the Nyquist frequency and how much time resolution you have in your data. That's just a detail of the Fourier analysis. So the more compact the object is, the higher the frequency that it can generate. For a black hole of that mass, the fundamental frequency of that black hole is going to be around 5 kilohertz. So something that is higher frequency than that, in principle, will need a more, well, nothing is more compact than a black hole, but you might need a black hole with a lower mass to get frequencies higher than 5 kilohertz. So something with 20 kilohertz in this scenario, maybe I'm just not creative enough, but I don't know how to get that. Okay, so technical details of what we are looking for and how we are looking for that. So we are looking for oscillations that are going to last for approximately 100 milliseconds, which agrees with what we expect the lifetime of the hypermassive neutron star to be from simulations. And we are...
So you're already
Right. We are actually going to find that the signal lasts only for like 10 milliseconds.
Again, that depends on the mass you're going to see.
Yeah.
Maybe just to follow that, I mean, do we know for sure it's going to be hypermassive? I mean, could you have something that's only supermassive or even stable?
Right. So it's... for a stable star, the frequencies would be different, I believe. For the, I don't make a lot of distinction between the hypermassive and the supermassive case. One needs differential rotation, the other one does not. I can't really go over there and ask how it is rotating, so I don't make that distinction. And it could be a supermassive neutron star. The very short duration of the signal that we found makes us believe that it's more compatible with a hypermassive neutron star. But again, there is a lot of interpretation that is possible, and we tried not to overstate a lot. I'm saying all the time that I'm talking all the time about hypermassive neutron star, bringing this from the motivation of the work, but we need to be a little bit careful with what we call the thing that we found.
How long do you expect a supermassive one to last?
It could last longer. So hypermassive neutron star is going to be lasting less than a second. Maybe the supermassive neutron star is going to be lasting closer to a second. The probably only equation that I have in my slides, I apologize for that, is this one here, which is just a simplified way of trying to estimate how significant a QPO could be in the signal if I'm measuring it in numbers of sigma, okay? So it's going to, the significance of the QPO is going to increase with the intensity of the gamma rays detected, with the fractional oscillation of the signal that is being caused, how long the QPO lasts, and it's inversely proportional to the width of the QPO. So if I have more photons, a larger fractional oscillation, a signal that lasts for longer, and a frequency that is better defined, all of this makes it easier to find the QPO and is going to make it more significant. Our actual analysis is done in terms of base factors, but this is like a guideline of how significant what we are looking for could be.
Just say that again, where you put it, so n is what? Is the number?
Number of sigma. So if I find, of significance, of a statistical significance. So like a 3 or a 4 or 5 sigma detection.
And the number is proportional to the ratio of the time duration of the system over variation.
Not the variation of the frequency, but the width of the frequency in the Fourier spectrum. So if I have a periodic signal that is very narrow, and I see lots of oscillations of it, my analysis is going to tell me that this is more statistically significant than if I have something that is a very broad peak that lasts with oscillations that last for a very short time.
I guess what I'm missing here is how people from here. So the QPO is something you're going to see in the electromagnetic spectrum.
Yes.
So whether I have something that brings at a single frequency versus a collection of frequencies where I want the delta F to be smaller and delta to be wide will depend on what is the assumption I'm going to make in how that translates into an impact on matter that it produces electromagnetic.
So oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So this formula here I used with one typical numerical relativity simulation to get, say, I want a 5 sigma detection. I have estimates for these things from the simulation. And this is the minimum intensity, which I translate into the minimum flux that I would need the detector to see in order to find a detection that strong. So I use that to make a flux cut and limit the number of GRBs that we were going to analyze.
Right, but I still am not understanding, I guess, I mean, it's natural to expect that the longer I shape the system, the more likely it is that I'm going to see something. But whether delta F should be the denominator or the numerator, I still don't know. Because it will depend on what is it I'm assuming will shape and translate into.
Right. So the delta F that I used for this crude estimate came from the width of the spectrum of a numerical relativity simulation.
That I don't care. Mm-hmm. So that I understand. Now you're going to make an assumption of how the shaking that you see or the gravitational wave contact that you see translate into an electromagnetic observable.
The assumption was that it translated exactly.
Okay.
And then we analyzed the data to see what the data was going to tell us. Sure. Yeah, and we did a Bayesian model comparison. One model we allowed to have only white noise. The other model we allowed to have white noise plus a QPO described as a Lorentzian peak. And for each short gamma ray burst that we analyzed, we split it into half overlapping segments to make sure that we didn't miss anything. They are all approximately 100 milliseconds long, but the exact duration depends on the native time resolution of the detector, so that we had a power of 2 segments to do a fast Fourier transform. So it's just a little bit of technical information there. Okay, so we set out to do this. We initially analyzed data from the SWIFT detector, and this slide is just about some lessons learned in the initial analysis, things that can go wrong, things that can cause fake QPOs. So first thing, SWIFT sees, well, we do see lots more long bursts than short bursts. With that flux cut, SWIFT didn't see a lot of short bursts, so we also analyzed long bursts just to add statistics and understand what was going on. So let's look at the short bursts first. It's the yellow distribution here. And we can see, looking at the light yellow distribution, that we have something here with a base factor of almost 200. And that starts being interesting. And what happened there is that in this light curve, the detector was hit by two cosmic rays. So light curve, spike, light curve, spike. Now our algorithm understood that the interval, the inverse of the interval between these two spikes was a frequency. So looking at the Fourier transform of that, there is a big peak exactly at that frequency. So this is something that we had to learn, that cosmic ray contamination could be a cause for false QPOs. So after we remove the spikes from the data, then we have the dark yellow distribution, and we see that there is nothing with a base factor larger than one. Basically nothing there that's interesting. Now, looking at the distribution of long bursts that we saw for SWIFT, first, all of the long bursts is the light gray distribution, and we have all of the bursts with all of the spikes. We see some base factors that are extremely large here. Once we remove the spikes from the sample, we have the dark gray distribution, and we have this guy here. This guy here has a base factor of approximately 3,000. And that's, yay, that's very interesting. What could that one be? Well, after we did a lot of analysis and found that it was something super interesting, and then we decided to talk with someone that really knew what was going on with the detector, we found that there was an undocumented effect from SWIFT, where they would send calibration pulses to the detectors when the detector was looing at the frequency that we were seeing. So, yay, our code works, and boo, the signal wasn't real. So that was heartbreaking, actually. So cosmic rays, detector artifacts. After the paper was published, they edited the documentation. And now that effect is documented. So you read about data corruption. So some people found strange things in the signal when the data was corrupted. And sometimes there is red noise contamination. Power is rising up towards lower frequencies. And then our algorithm tries to fit that rising up with a QPO at low frequencies. So these are all things that we learned in our initial analysis. Okay, so then we added to the SWIFT sample a Fermi GBM sample and a BATSE sample. So SWIFT and Fermi are gamma ray detectors that are still working. I'm going to tell you more about BATSE in the next slide. We analyzed more than 700 short GRBs. Each one is split into segments, analyzing the way that I described, and remembering anything to the left of base factor equals one is favoring the noise only model. Anything to the right is favoring the noise plus QPO model. So basically nothing interesting except for maybe these guys here in the BATSE data that are starting to be interesting. So we're going to look into the BATSE data a little bit more carefully. Now some words about BATSE. And if you guys are theorists like me, and you attend astrophysics talks, and your eyes glaze over when people are talking about the satellites and the detectors and this and that and the other, I hear you. I really do. But I have an interesting story to tell you about BATSE. BATSE was an instrument on board the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, and that was one of NASA's great observatories from the 90s. If you never heard of the great observatories, Hubble was one of them. So NASA had great observatories working in gamma rays, X-rays, in the optic, and the infrared. Compton was the gamma ray observatory, and it was absolutely transformative. Because back in the day in the 90s, people didn't know if gamma ray bursts were from local sources in our galaxy or from cosmological sources all over the universe. And it was the almost 3,000 GRBs detected by BATSE that showed a distribution that was isotropic in the sky, showing that these sources had to be cosmological. And that was an era of heroic space exploration. So you probably know, although many people here are too young to remember it, that when Hubble was put in space, Hubble needed a new pair of glasses. So you had astronauts coming and putting lenses, correcting this thing. When Compton was put up, again, by astronauts in the space shuttle, it had to open an antenna, and the antenna was stuck. Now, what do you do if you're putting something in space and it's stuck and it doesn't open? You send an astronaut out on a spacewalk, and that astronaut whacked the antenna by hand several times until the thing went loose and eventually open. So this is awesome. We don't have that stuff happening anymore, and we definitely should. Now, the sad thing, sorry?
Walking stuff, we don't have that.
Walking in space.
Walking.
And the whacking. The whacking is really cool.
Space room, by the way, so you map somebody.
I'm the one with the hockey stick. If anyone's going to be doing the whacking, that would be me. But the sad story with Compton, because Hubble is still up and running, Chandra was the X-ray Great Observatory still up and running, but Compton lost a gyroscope in 2000. And it had a spare, so it was still doing fine. But if it were to lose an extra gyroscope, then it could not be controlled. So it was a very difficult decision that had to be made. And they decided to deorbit it safely so that it wouldn't hit anything in space. Apparently, there was a lot of pressure from the Russians because of their space station back in the day. And it fell in the ocean. It now sadly sleeps with the fishes and observes the ocean from the inside. And because it was one of the great observatories, Betsy, the detector, had a detector area much larger than anything that we have working now. And that's very important. So, we took the Betsy data that we had analyzed, and we reanalyzed it, taking only the counts in the higher energies. It had only 4 energy channels, so we took only energy channels 3 and 4. And the reason for that is that short bursts have a harder spectrum, so the noise is going to be more important than the signal in the lower frequencies. Or let's turn it around. I expect that the signal is going to be more important than the noise in the higher energies. Did I say frequencies before? Apologies. If I made you confused, we've reanalyzed the data looking only at the higher energies with the expectation that this would increase the signal to noise ratio of the signal that we were looking for. And basically, this one of the guys that was here came over here. This one was a little bit farther in, but it came over here. And now we have clear outliers in our distribution.
So you're wrong. Did you explain what the model is and I miss it? Or like what, when you say noise only or noise plus QPO, how do you inject the QPO and the noise? And what is it that you're looking for? The spectra of the GRB, if I missed that.
The data we are analyzing is short gamma ray burst data.
Sure.
So we have each event has a light curve, which is number of photons versus time. From that time series, we take the Fourier spectrum. And that we analyze with 2 different models. One that says we have white noise only, which means it averages to a constant in the frequencies that we're looking at. And the other model says that we have white noise plus a QPO modeled as a Lorentzian. So it is a constant with a broad peak added to it.
Good, thank you. So but why is the white noise only model sensible? I mean, why would they?
Oh, at high frequencies, we do expect to only have white noise. At low frequencies, we expect to have red noise that increases. It doesn't mean that the spectrum is going to be a constant, but you're going to have a very spiky frequency spectrum that averages to a constant.
Well, maybe just follow that. I mean, is there no prediction for some spectrum, like some astrophysical spectrum that's not a QPO?
Yeah. So the GRB light curves are very spiky, very stochastic, very noisy if you look at their frequency spectrums. Just something like that. And there are models for GRB light curves. For example, something called a FRED model is a fast rise and an exponential decay. But then you add a lot of Poisson fluctuation on top of it, and you can have a light curve that sort of looks like what you see in reality. I'm going to show some synthetic light curves as well that might help. But in terms of a physical model, no, we don't really have one. I mean, we have the one that we are trying to probe here.
But if you, for example, fit that model you said, this fast rise plus noise, then does this, and see if that's preferred over noise plus QPO, like we've done that?
The fast rise plus exponential decay, that's something that you would put in the time domain. So we created lots of those light curves, and we used those to go through our pipeline of analysis and see whether they would create QPOs as strong as those that we saw in the actual data. And the answer was that, not really. But I do have a slide about that. If it doesn't help you, just let me know.
I'm still a bit confused about the noise. So the noise, you mean the white noise is just the white noise of the CCD, right? Or is the white noise of the shot noise of the signal that you're talking about?
No, we do have Poisson noise, so that's unavoidable. That's the photon counting noise.
Right,
that's what you're referring to. That's Poisson noise.
So the white noise is the CCD noise.
The white noise was there to account for spikes in the light curve, because if you have a spike, the Fourier transform of a delta is a constant.
Yeah.
If your signal is very spiky in the time domain, you're going to have extra noise in the Fourier domain. So instead of averaging to the Poisson level, that means no extra power, if you have extra spikiness in the time domain, that level of noise could be raised.
Right.
So we allowed for that.
And those spikes are the spikes from your GRB signal or spikes from, say, your cosmic rays that are also hitting the CCD?
Could be anyway. But it is possible, as I was mentioning in the analysis of the SWIFT data, it is possible to see things that really look like cosmic rays, because it's a sharp increase in counts in a single time bin.
So what's the resolution of sampling frequency of the CCD?
It depends on the detector. For Fermi GBM and for BAT-C, it is 2 microseconds.
Okay.
For SWIFT BAT, it is 100 microseconds. So for SWIFT, we could go to 5 kilohertz. For GBM and for BAT-C, we could go to higher Nyquist frequencies. Okay. Maybe this answers some questions that have been coming. This is an example, or these are the two examples where we found QPOs. So there on the left, you have the actual light curves of these two bursts. In the middle, you can see in red what is the actual Fourier spectrum. In black, it's overlaid the best model, that is white noise plus 2 QPOs. And we have the dynamical spectrogram on the right. So people are asking about the white noise. It means that, in our normalization, Poisson only has a power of 1 instead of the standard Leahy normalization where Poisson only has a power of 2. The added white noise that we can have means that this level here can be 1 plus the added noise. So that's a parameter that we fit for. And the dashed lines here, they are showing the segments, how it just happened that the segments that we analyzed were split. And where we see the high base factor is in this segment and in this segment here. The bands, the red bands here, they are showing you with what is the confidence that we would have for these powers to be, how high they could be if you only had noise and no signal in the light curve. So 1, 2, 3 sigma, considering noise only. And this gray band is showing you the plus minus 1 sigma band for the best noise plus QPO model. Now, and what we can see here is that these frequencies, they appear in the beginning of the light curve. So as the light curve is growing, we see that, and then we don't see them anymore.
Can you explain this? How do you see that?
Oh, because here we have the light curve, and here we have the spectrogram at the same time. So this time here, the spectrogram was used with a rolling 8-millisecond window. So we can see that everything is here in the beginning of the light curve. And the same thing here. And this one it's easier to see, and it had a higher base factor too. It's kind of nice that if you look underneath the curve, you can actually see that the QPO went up, because we don't see the red curves anymore underneath.
So you see two peaks in the power spectrum. Both of them QPOs.
Both are QPOs. So we compared noise plus 1 QPO with noise only. And then we compared with noise plus 2 QPOs to make sure that the second QPO was also still statistically significant. Adding a third QPO improves the base factor, but not enough to justify the extra parameters. But the second QPO is statistically significant. And it also makes these two bursts pop out more from the distribution of the rest of the bursts.
It seems the frequency of the higher frequency QPO, right, are very close to each other.
They are. Yeah, they are very, very close to 2.6 kilohertz, and the secondary frequency is close to 1,000 hertz. One is a little bit below, the other one is a little bit above.
Do you have these GRPs?
We do not. I'm going to talk about that.
How many samples do you get of
QPO? About 26.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 2.6 kilohertz, 10 milliseconds. Yeah. And you can also see that these QPOs that we find, they are way narrower than what we were seeing in that example of numerical relativity curves, where we had much broader spectral features. Okay, so a little something that gamma ray people might appreciate, that's the distribution in terms of duration of the burst and hardness ratio, basically how much you have in the higher energies over how much you have in the lower energies. These 100, 300, those are in KeV. That's the unit of energy here. And that's the entire Batsy catalog with their uncertainties, or two bursts are there. So they are very short, but they are not the shortest. They are hard, but they're also not the hardest. They are there in the distribution of short bursts. They're definitely short, but they are not the shortest ones that we had. And here, this is a crude estimate for the peak flux of the Batsy catalog of GRBs. And what we see is that if we consider all of the energies, or if we consider only the higher energies, our bursts don't stand out too terribly much from the rest of the distribution. So they don't seem to be very special, except for the fact that they're short and they do show QPOs.
And you analyze all of them?
Yes. Well, all of the short bursts, sure. Not all of the long bursts. Yeah.
I guess that question, that the one I have in my back, of my mind, if you're at the end of the year, you're going to claim you see QPRs, but you only see two out of several hundreds.
Yes, so.
Just,
yes, and we did try to estimate that because you are absolutely correct. The base factor analysis only tells us this much. It tells us that for this data, one model is very much preferred over the other model. But there can be other stuff going on. Maybe one of the models was not very good, right? And that's why it's disfavored. Maybe even though the models were good and everything is above board, maybe there was just a chance that by accident, the noise fluctuations would cause this to happen. So this is something that we did a lot of work to try to estimate. I have, I think, 3 slides for that. Okay, so here we have a distribution of delta log likelihood between the model with 2 QPOs and the model with 0 QPOs. And we need to do delta log likelihoods and not base factors because we have the extra parameters for the second QPO and it's just too much computing time to calculate base factors for the model with 2 QPOs for all of the GRBs, all of the BATSI GRBs. So we have the distribution for the BATSI burst that we actually analyzed in purple. Our signals are highlighted, and this one, we would kind of like to take another look of that one later. And we have a distribution where we really only had Poisson fluctuation. So the bulk of the distribution is very similar to Poisson fluctuation. So if I have a signal that only has Poisson fluctuation and I run it through our pipeline and I try to see by how much the model with 2 QPOs is preferred over the model with 0 QPOs, these are the values that I'm going to get. Yeah.
Is the Poisson noise distribution, is that Poisson noise just a constant source or are these spread spiky things?
I now don't remember if that distribution was done in the time domain and then transformed or whether it was originally already done in the Fourier domain, but I can get back to you on that. Okay, so then now what we did was the following. We took our 2 bursts with signals, and now the light curves are binned with finer resolution. The data is in blue. We had a nice model that allowed for a hyperbolic tangent grow and then a decay like this. And we fit that model to both of them. We have the black thick curve there. On top of that thick smooth curve, we can add a sampling of Poisson fluctuation. So 2 examples are here. One is here, one is there. If I take those 2 examples just for didactic purposes and I calculate their power spectra, I have this here, and I don't really have anything special going on. So what I did was take a light curve that very much looked like the one I analyzed, but by construction didn't have any QPOs. I analyze it, and I don't see anything special. Okay, so these are just 2 examples. Now, we did a buttload of examples of each one of those 2, and we made a distribution of the delta log likelihoods that we found. So for our first burst, this was the value of the actual data, and this is the distribution that we found after running some 10,000 of those. I don't remember anymore now. So we had to extrapolate in order to get a p-value for this, which we found with the data. Now we did the same thing for the second burst. For the second burst, with some about, I think, 5,000 tries, we found examples that were stronger than this, which gave us a lower p-value here. Okay. So far, so good? Okay.
So, but there is a question of Lucasper effect, right? Because you picked out the broadest ones and this analysis.
Oh, we used the entire catalog for estimating the actual significance of our findings. So maybe that answers your question. So what we found is that here we have the shortest bursts in our sample. And what we found is that the probability of finding something with a delta log likelihood larger than what we found for the first or for the second bursts, that probability drops precipitously with the duration of the burst. So basically, if we want to account for all of the 700 bursts that we analyzed, the only ones that increase the probability of finding something by chance are the shortest ones in our sample. So we use all of those to get the combined false probability that this one and this one happened by accident and put it at 3 × 10⁻¹. Okay, so now that I brought you...
I guess that also one thing that should be done is then also take data when there's no gamma ray burst, you just have cosmics in the background, and you run your code, like you analyze like shots of say 20 milliseconds, you do it 1,000 times because where JRB dataset has 1,000 samples or 100 samples, and then you check if there in data your code gives you a QB.
Right, so we actually did that. I didn't mention it, but thanks for the question. For the Swift data that we analyzed, that was the one with the most problematic cosmic ray contamination as well. The data that we had for each burst contained extra time before and after the T100. Yes. So for every Swift burst that we analyzed, we had data segments of only background readings from the detector, and nothing came out. So we had only the few examples where we had two cosmic rays very nearby, and those we understood already. So just the background fluctuation doesn't give us anything. Mm-hmm. I believe we also did that for that Poisson curve, the gray curve that I showed with the big peak. So that was a similar thing, but not for actual data. That was synthetic data. We did do it for actual Swift data. Mm-hmm. So after the statistical significance of the bursts, I brought you to the fun simulation that maybe you have not seen before, which is a possible interpretation of what's happening here. So we have the two neutron stars. This is midway through the binary merger simulation. We're going to have the frequency of the gravitational waves increasing, coming down. The two neutron stars are going to merge. You're going to hear the sound of the gravitational wave. So on top of the chirp, pay attention that once the hypermassive neutron star is formed, frequency jumps up. Then the black hole is formed, the frequency dies, and we're going to have the gamma ray light curve lighting up when we get there. And we are going to be showing the two QPOs as well. So pay attention. If it goes. Ah, no. No. sounds like a kettle, doesn't it?
So how do you get the dot plot particles? So this one comes out of the simulation. That one?
It is an interpretation. Okay. That simulation is not a simulation of this event. But we are saying that this is an interpretation of what could have caused that one over there. So we did it so that the QPOs that we see here happened when the light curve was over here, and then the black hole was formed, and over here there was no sound anymore. So it is a visualization, it's not a simulation that was done reproducing the data.
You should.
I think so.
But then you're speculating, or at least one of the outcomes here is that you're going to say that the G or B has nothing to do with the formation of the black hole, but was produced, was driven by the stage where the hypermassive universe decided what to do.
The G or B in this interpretation would have started while the hypermassive neutron star was still there, but the light curve reaches maximum once the black hole is there. Another possibility. Yeah, and they are. Because the frequencies that we see in time, they are basically just over here. And then we don't see any more QPO over there.
And you're saying the QPO content of the GRB happens while you still have the hypermassive neutron star.
That is one possibility. Remember that I described two possibilities. One that is connected with the hypermassive neutron star. It happens while the hypermassive neutron star is there. And the other possibility is that the hypermassive neutron star is gone. The black hole has already formed. But that modulation of the GRB comes from the modulated ejecta that is outside of the black hole. It is also possible that this modulation comes from details of the accretion of this matter onto the central black hole. So we cannot tell from the data that we have analyzed.
Maybe related to that, I mean, so the star will have a lot of oscillations, but not all of them will show that the gravitational waves, like, right, if you have like a curvy, like if the star roughly certainly symmetric, and then there's a radial oscillation that would produce any gravitational waves, but it can still modulate the matter and everything a lot, right?
Right. The frequency of the radial oscillations of the hypermassive neutron star is different, and it's lower than this. So there are people who describe the secondary peak, the one with lower frequencies, as a combination of the main peak and a quasi-radial oscillation, for example. So these things have been calculated. The hypermassive neutron star in its entirety, it's very far from being spherically symmetric. So you don't have a purely radial oscillation mode because the star is deformed. So you can talk about quasi-radial oscillations, and those have been calculated.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, there'll be lots of oscillations at different frequencies than dynamical.
Yes.
At all, just at the gravitational waves.
Sure. And it's a very noisy signal as well. So if you have modes that are excited with low amplitudes, they're not going to show up very much.
I guess you're playing from the other side. When you have a system that's fairly simple, it's time scale. Anything there that is of relevance will happen in milliseconds time scale. So you would argue, well, it's not surprising that any feature that might show up over there, it's milliseconds, but it need not have necessarily anything to do with the gravitational waves frequency. You see what I'm saying? It's like I'm collecting black holes. If I get anything that has scale n, also b, that's the scale of the problem. It could be a plethora. I can call for a plethora of processes that are playing around, but if all are within millisecond time scale, well, it's going to show up. And it need not have anything to do. The correlation that you see does not necessarily mean causation.
Right. I'm going to start with disagreeing where you said that this is a very simple system. Maybe I see it being very complicated, but that's besides the point. You are absolutely correct that time scale has to do with the mass and the the mass is either the mass in the hypermassive neutron star or the mass of the black hole that was formed. So they are going to have approximately the same mass. However, the characteristic frequency of the hypermassive neutron star is going to be around 2.5 kilohertz, and the characteristic frequency of that black hole of the same mass is going to be around 5 kilohertz. So there is a big difference here, and that just comes from the scattering problem, if I'm calculating quasi-normal modes here.
Right, but
you could have
directly from those frequencies into something. I mean, whatever processes those natural frequencies can bring it up by a factor of 2 or 3 up or down. I mean, you could easily think of that of that process playing a role. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So thinking exactly what is the process that is translating frequencies of gravitational waves in numerical relativity simulations to modulation of gamma ray photons that have been detected is absolutely a complicated thing, and we are not saying that we did it. We have a couple of possibilities of how this connection could happen, but definitely hypermassive neutron stars is not the only one of them. For example, you could have this frequency coming from the like in the disk QPOs that have been seen in X-rays, where these are coming from accretion matter around the black hole and the X-rays being emitted by the disk. Maybe there is something similar happening here. You would have to have the this frequency coming from this high kilohertz frequency coming somehow from the disk, but those disk QPOs, which are coming from the accretion onto the black hole, they are much lower frequencies than what we are seeing here. And even in those cases, there isn't still a good unified description of what exactly is causing those QPOs. So just saying it could be, but if that is the case, we also don't have a very good description that connects motion of matter into the disk with the exact frequencies that we see in the X-ray QPOs. But you are correct. There could be other things playing a role here. And we have good reasons to believe that the hypermassive neutron star phase happens. The frequency that we found is consistent with the numerical relativity frequencies. So that makes us think that there could be a connection here. But we definitely did not do the full modeling of how you bridge that. I mean, I wouldn't have the nerve to give that to a student, right? I'm not that mean to my students. Okay, more questions? I think that we are already way past the hour. My apologies. So I think that all that I had was a bit of a summary slide of the things that we have seen here. With those are the frequencies of the lower frequency, the upper frequency. If this is related to the angular frequency of the hypermassive neutron star, these stars would be spinning twice as fast as the fastest known pulsar, and they would have to be spinning differentially at those rates. Our signal lasts for 10 milliseconds, which I Googled, and it's faster than the blink of an eye. So that slide remained from the press briefing presentation at the AAS. Oh, I forgot I had added this one. So this is important. I'm very conscious about the time, so I'm just going to say that, Luis, you asked about the distance. We do not have the distance because the Betsy sky localization has an error of about 10 degrees. So that means in the correct direction of the sky, it is something this big, an area that you have to look at, and you have a lot of galaxies there. So those frequencies could have been redshifted. If they were redshifted, that means that we have a lower limit on those frequencies. If I put that together with some phenomenological relations found in numerical relativity simulations, that limits the maximum radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star, and I can place that together with what we know from gravitational waves and from NICER. And basically, I'm cutting this block over here. If people want to talk about the equation of state, I'm very happy to do that afterwards. The way to find that redshift that we don't know is by identifying the galaxy. And one way to identify the galaxy 30 years after the event is by looking for something that lasts for a very long time. So for example, looking for the radio afterglow. So there are different models. If you have more or less magnetic field, what you're going to see is going to depend on your angle of observation, but after 30 years, that doesn't matter too much anymore. And it's going to be challenging. And we have a radio astronomer that decided to join our group and said, challenge accepted. Okay. People have asked us why BATSY was the instrument where we found these QPOs, and it's basically because BATSY was amazing. Look at that effective area, right? It's larger than anything that we have. It's larger than anything that we are planning to have. So it wasn't for nothing an instrument in one of the great observatories. And that's it, and thank you very much. Happy to answer more questions. Sorry for running over time. Thank you.
So, like you said in your slide, at least for one event, we know the timing between the whoop and the ding, it was like 1.7 seconds. And you also mentioned how on those timescales we expect, if it does form a hypermassive neutron star, for the oscillations to die down significantly after like that long a timescale.
Mm-hmm.
So is the idea that in some cases, this TRB is forming during the phase when the hypermassive neutron star is oscillating, and in other cases, like the one we observed in gravitational waves, it's not, or do you think that wouldn't apply to the LIGO event?
Well, I think that although many, many papers have been written about that 1.7 second difference, probably our best understanding now is that that difference refers to the time that it takes for the jet to break out of the ejecta and actually the gamma rays start traveling towards us. Because there is a lot of stuff around the star, and you have to have the jet being launched, you have a cocoon that's initially formed, the jet has to go through. And if only I had someone here with a better understanding of jet structure, and I'm looking at you there in the back. Would you like to say something?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it might take some time for the jet to launch. There's a time for it to burrow out of the star. There's also a time it needs to take to get to the radius of where it starts emitting. And it's okay with 7 because we were looking at this thing off axis. There's a geometric effect there. It's traveling at the speed of light. 20 degrees off to the side, so that there's some you know, a few tenths of a second. There's a handful of a few tenths of a second things you can add up there. I don't know if we have a full understanding of it yet, but.
And there are a lot of questions. And then there's a lot of stuff that happens, as you say, from the engine to the moment you actually generate that what we see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you see many options or very few options for that structure that they are calling for emanating from the very inner engines to actually be endowed elsewhere as it collides with the ISM or whatever it happens before?
Yeah, I mean, for the prompt, you have one of the common models for the prompt emission is this internal shock model, where the idea is that the ejected in the jet is made of several shells, all the endurance factors, and that they're all traveling almost the speed of light, but not quite, and so it takes them a long time from all they catch up with each other. But when they do, they shock, get hot, and lose all the energies. But those shells are released by Zeppelin. So the Zeppelin is vibrating at some frequency. Those shells would sort of be emitted, plus what could be modulated at that frequency, and that may modulate the collision times as well.
can I ask you to speculate? So suppose now there's a collision, two neutron stars come together and they are shy, so they're not very massive. So you're going to have very long, either massive neutron star failure, yeah, even below those that are massive, so they can last forever. So how would that feature be? So if I check the first, what, third of that device, as you said, it has something to do with the massive neutron star.
Yeah, so if those...
This maintain and, you know, very long. Yeah, that's what you speculate what happens.
Right, right. So if you had the case where the two neutron stars are very light and they merge and they form a stable neutron star, and there is also a GRB launched in that case, right? And that stable neutron star there is formed close to maximum mass, right? And it's oscillating because it was caused in this smashing, and this oscillation is transported somehow to the gamma ray burst. Then that frequency here would have to be lower.
Not much.
Not by much, but it would have to be lower because this is more like a P mode and not an F mode for a neutron star.
That mode, well, sorry, I don't know my alphabet of modes. But that main mode, that main frequency, that very little to do with the natural frequency of the star. Most of it has to do with the size of the star, the equation state, and how it comes. This very easy conversion of that, the orbital frequency at which they make contact and the frequency you see. So it's not a natural frequency of star. If the collision hadn't happened, I wouldn't see that frequency. And it has to do with this bar that is going around at that frequency that is intimately related to the orbital frequency at which they encounter each other.
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Okay,
really?
I'm the one saying that, so I have no problem.
Okay, so what I'm going to say is that, again, depending on who you ask, they are going to say that that frequency is from a mode of oscillation of the star, or that that frequency is just from the rotation of the star, which has to do with how it came together in the binary. But the thing is that it doesn't matter. You can have one description or the other description, and you're going to end up with the same frequency and with the same properties. And that is, I think, quite extraordinary, and it also shows that you don't have a lot of freedom when you're working with neutron stars. It cannot be very different if you're still calling it a neutron star. So,
it would not be very different. I mean, it won't be about too different. 30% up or down, however you want to call it, as it changes the masses. So what I'm trying to say, what would be the smoking answer would you be looking for? When following your model, what would you say the main features that would be a consequence?
Yeah, I would still say that that frequency would be lower than what we see, because you're looking for an...
See that you saw those two events.
Yeah.
No, I'm thinking there would be a new event.
Right. So we would. In principle, I would say that the frequency could be lower and the signal could last for longer. That is a possibility, right? If you say that the signal lasts for as long as the central engine is there to provide that modulation, maybe we would see that frequency, that modulation during the entire T100. Of the gamma ray burst. But that again depends on modeling that is very complicated. So it could be that even if the central engine is there and lasts for a very long time, you only get to see it in the rise of the gamma ray light curve because of reasons related to how the gamma rays are being emitted. And I don't know the answer to that question. Sure. Yeah.
Why? Do you have any ideas for why these two would show this and not the other 400?
Yeah. So we try to answer the question of what make these two bursts special. And other than the fact that they do have QPOs and that they are among the shortest bursts that we have seen, we were not able to find anything that's very special about them.
And these were only BATS events?
Yeah, both of them are BATS events. So in the hardness ratio versus T90, yeah, they're short, but nothing more than that. In the peak flux, which I had to estimate making some crude assumptions, they have, so this, the best event, sure, it's at the end of the tail of distribution here. The other one, not so much, is much closer to the peak of the distribution. So does this mean that it's rare that we create hypermassive neutron stars, if that's the correct interpretation? Does it mean that there is something about how we can see these modulations, maybe a specific line of sight or clear propagation region or polluted propagation region or something that reduces by a lot the chances that we see it from every burst? That's a question to which I don't yet have a good answer. I just have answers about what did not make them special. But happy to talk more about that.
I guess you would say that these two were somehow the lightest masses, so that it was a hypermassive neutron star within 1 million seconds, but all the others just immediately collapsed on that hole and would be able to shut off.
Yeah, it could be. That depends on the distribution of masses of neutron stars in binaries that merge within a Hubble time. And we don't really have that distribution yet. So.
But I guess for a lot of these systems, they were like sufficiently loud that you could rule out there being QPUs that are kind of proportional to their like overall luminosity or something.
Sorry, could you repeat again at the beginning?
I'm just saying, like, if you assume that every short gamma ray burst is like basically the same, they're just at different distances or something, then you, this is inconsistent with that. But the other ones having QPUs and they're just being lost in the noise. If they're like the same
right.
In proportion to like the overall luminosity of the burst.
Right, so the distance is also important, right? You can ask yourself, if I put this source farther and farther away, how far can I put it that I'm still going to be able to see this? But maybe the angle is more important than that, because these gamma ray bursts are very collimated, right? So I think that maybe line of sight is more important than distance, although distance probably would play a role as well.
Does your sample include your favorite long, short,
that was a swift burst from 2112.11a.
Which one?
2112.11a. The long short burst?
No, I don't think so. Not sure we have that one, but we could. Did it have a high flux?
Yes.
Okay, so it may be in our sample, and I might be able to find that information for you.
Oh, we should check. Mm-hmm.
We have been trying to look at, I think, 1806-18.
Sure.
you know what? Usually I was thinking, how do people even know these numbers, right? Is there a way that I should know all of these telephone numbers of these things? And then I realized that people only know the number of the one they work with. It's not like they know all of the numbers.
Okay. If no more questions, thanks, Cecilia.
Thank you very much.